We're doing Parshat Emor. We'll do a quick overview of the Parsha, and then we'll review it with more depth. Our Parsha has mitzvos that pertain to Kohanim, and our Parsha encompasses the mitzvos of the holidays. So, the first mitzvah is that a Kohen is not allowed to defile himself. He's not allowed to enter a cemetery or come in contact with a dead body, other than the relatives, right? Father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, wife, seven. Very good. The Kohen Gadol doesn't even get defiled for them. If a Kohen becomes defiled, he may not serve in the temple until nightfall. The Kohen is limited in as to whom he may marry. He may not marry a divorcee. He may not marry a woman who had intimate relations with someone that's prohibited. He may not marry a girl whose father is not Jewish, even though her mother is Jewish. Kohen may not marry...
He has to marry a virgin, right?
No. The Kohen Gadol has to marry a virgin.
The father isn't Jewish. May he marry a halala?
No.
Wait. So
it's a separate concept.
I didn't know that.
That's true. Most people don't know that. But now you do. A Kohen may not marry a halala, which is a woman who is from Kohanic family that had an improper marriage in their lineage. A Kohen is not allowed to enter the temple when he's defiled, and the Kohen Gadol has more mitzvos. He's not allowed to become defiled, even for his relatives. And the Kohen Gadol has one more woman that he's prohibited from marrying, which is a widow. A regular Kohen may marry a widow. The Kohen, when he has a blemish, is not allowed to do service in the temple. And the Kohen, when he has a blemish, is not even allowed to enter the temple. Kohen, when he's defiled, is not allowed to do service. And he's not allowed to eat from the truma. A person who is a non-Kohen may not eat from the truma either. Only Kohanim may eat. And if a person eats from truma, not only does he get Misa B'dei Shamayim, he also has to pay plus a tax. He has to pay back the Kohanim and add a fifth. And we will discuss how you calculate that fifth when we review. A Kohen's servants may not eat truma. A Kohen who is not circumcised may not eat truma. Special mitzvah about circumcision. A woman may eat from certain sacrifices, a female Kohen, a Kohen's wife, a Kohen's daughter, before she gets married. But if the family is halalim, so she is a...
If she gets married to a Kohen, she can still eat it, right?
A Kohen's wife may eat truma, right? Now, even a Kohen may not eat tevel. Tevel is the crops before you took off your truma, the gifts to the Kohen. So that's tevel. Now, when you have an animal that's designated for the temple, so if that animal has a blemish, then you can redeem that animal. But there's a special prohibition not to blemish the animal. Let's say you designated Betsy the cow, and your daughter comes home and says, "Dad, you can't slaughter Betsy." And you say, "I'm sorry, I already designated Betsy for a sacrifice." And your daughter says, "Dad, get out of it. No, I don't want Betsy to go." So you say, "I have a solution. No problem. Bring me the hammer." You bop Betsy on the nose. You bop Betsy on the ear. You make a blemish. And then you say, "No, now I could redeem Betsy." No, there's a biblical prohibition. You're not allowed to make a blemish on an animal that's already designated to the temple. Now, once an animal has a blemish, so then there's a biblical prohibition. You're not allowed to slaughter it as a sacrifice.
It's not allowed at all, I think, to blemish an animal on purpose. Like,
can't even a kid who's in there, like, can't a little child blemish the animal?
So, generally, you're not supposed to do that.
But the child's not paid with her.
Okay, so we educate children not to do things that are prohibited. We'll discuss the mitzvah of education when we review the parasha with more depth. We have a very interesting prohibition not to castrate animals. Meaning we have a prohibition, you're not allowed to cause an animal to be infertile. People don't know this. We have a mitzvah, right, it doesn't matter if it's your cow or your dog or your cat. We have a mitzvah that although we accept sacrifices from non-Jews, we do not accept the sacrifice that the animal has a serious blemish in it. So their criterion for a blemish is less stringent than ours, but nonetheless, the Torah in our parsha prohibits offering a sacrifice from a non-Jew that has a blemish. We have a very interesting mitzvah that says, don't slaughter a mother and her baby on the same day in the temple or even outside the temple. Meaning, they would the butchers would keep an exact accounting of where the mothers and their children were, because if you sold an animal to someone on Erev Chag, you know, on Erev Yom Tov, everyone's slaughtering the animals for Yom Tov today, right? So if you sold the mother, you weren't allowed to sell her children that day. If you sold the baby calves, you weren't allowed to sell the mother that day. You're not allowed to slaughter them both on the same day. And then we have a mitzvah that's one of the weightiest mitzvahs in the Torah. The Torah says you're not allowed to desecrate God's name. So that means when people look at us and they see the way a Jew behaves, we have to sanctify God's name and not be a source for the desecration of his name. And that plays itself out in many different ways. So if a non-Jew comes to a Jew and says, I want you to publicly transgress Shabbos. I want you to show that the mitzvahs don't count. That's a chilul Hashem. Yes. It's a biblical mitzvah in our parsha. So what constitutes a chilul Hashem? So that's a discussion in halacha. But we ordinarily assume that if I publicly do an aveira, if one were to go in front of 10 people and show them, look, what difference does it make that Shabbos? I'm turning on the light. That's a chilul Hashem. And then we have the Yomim Tovim. So we have the mitzvah of Pesach. We have the holiday, the first day and the seventh day of Pesach. We have the Torah's mitzvah. We don't eat from the grains that grew this year until the first day Chol HaMoed, right? On the first day Chol HaMoed Pesach, there was a special sacrifice brought. And only after that sacrifice was brought, the Korban HaOmer, it was the volume of an Omer. Omer is a measurement. Yes, yes. Yashan means the old grain, meaning once you brought that sacrifice, so all the grain is considered like it's old grain, it's grain from last year. Because we measure the grain based on the second day, the first day Chol HaMoed.
But it's spelled, not grain, right?
Correct. The sacrifice was brought from barley. The sacrifice itself was brought from shibboleth, from barley. What?
Is it the same spell?
No. Okay, you meant something other than I understood. Then we have the mitzvah of Shavuos, that we count 7 weeks up to Shavuos. We have the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah. We have the mitzvah of Yom Kippur. We have the mitzvah not to eat or drink on Yom Kippur. We have the mitzvah of Sukkot, the first day, the eighth day of Sukkot. And that's our parsha. So we just covered all the mitzvahs of the parsha, more or less. Etrog, we'll get there. Okay, yes. Mita bidei shemayim means death at the hands of heaven. Sometimes we have the death penalty administered by the courts below. That's chiyuv misa, that he gets a death penalty. And sometimes you have misa bidei shemayim at the hands of the courts up above.
And this guy is basically
there are certain sins that we are told that God says, I will cause him to die, which means if maybe when he was born, they allotted him 120 years, after he did that sin, they might tell him, okay, you're going to die at 52 instead of at 120, or at 51, or at 50, or at 45.
It's crazy that I think that the punishment is that this guy dies an early death, and you're like, oh, by the way, you're fine. It's funny.
Oh, so Karet and Misa B'dei Shemayim are similar but not identical. What? I didn't hear you. There was one prime Mizbeach for sacrifices, and then there was a small Mizbeach that was about this size, you know, small like this shtender, which was used for offering the incense, the Ktores. And that was the Mizbeach made of gold, and that was inside the holy. And on Yom Kippur and specific sacrifices, there were special sacrifices that which blood was sprinkled on that altar. No sacrifice was burnt on it. The only thing that was burnt on it was the Ktores.
So when people were bringing their sacrifices before Yom Kippur, they all did it on that one Mizbeach?
The one Mizbeach outside.
There must have been thousands of people.
Right. So the Mishnah discusses they had an assembly line of Kohanim. and certain sacrifices, that deserves a broader discussion about where and how it was done. But generally, yes. The general understanding is that, yes.
Did they provide a sacrifice like four people together? Was it really prolific?
Well, yes, people chipped in together for the Paschal offering and for other offerings, yes. Right? It says that it was a lot. Yes, it was. Okay. Mangal, yeah, okay. Our parsha begins with the responsibility that Kohanim have not to become defiled. And when the Torah words it, the Torah says, Emor ela Kohanim, say to the Kohanim, v'amarta alehem, and you should say unto them. So our sages say, why does it say, Emor v'amarta, say to the Kohanim, and you should say. What is that? So our sages derived from that there's a responsibility that you're telling the Kohanim, and say unto them, you're telling them they should say. Meaning, say to the Kohanim that they should say. Who should they say to? To their children. Ordinarily, when it comes to all the mitzvahs of the Torah, so the Torah says, what you have to do is teach your child that when he will become an adult, he's responsible to keep the mitzvahs of the Torah. There are a few mitzvahs where the Torah says, you make sure your kid keeps this one. You know one example, kosher. You know another example, Shabbos. There are a few mitzvot where the Torah says, you as a parent are responsible for your kid. Don't just teach him that when he'll become an adult, he'll do it. Just make sure he keeps it now too. Shabbos, Kashrus. And here's another one. The Kohanim watch their children that they don't become defiled. So that means, if there's a Kohen who has a baby, and his wife has to go to the funeral, even though female Kohanim are permitted to go to funeral, they're permitted. Now, they don't have this prohibition not to become defiled, but children are prohibited. So this woman can't go to the funeral with her baby, if it's a baby boy. The boys, right. The boys are not allowed to become defiled. So male Kohanim have this huge responsibility not to become defiled and not to let their kids become defiled. So when we speak about our responsibility to children, we have to understand there's the biblical mitzvah of chinuch and the rabbinic mitzvah of chinuch. The biblical mitzvah, with regards to most mitzvot, is to have the child understand that when he will be bar mitzvah, when he will be an adult, he will be responsible for this mitzvah. The rabbinic mitzvah of chinuch is that you get the kid to practice. That means that when you buy lulav and esrog, you give it to your son and you say, here's how you shake it. And you shake it with him. What mitzvahs do we do? We buy our children little tzitzis, right? Once the kid is toilet trained, he's 3 years old, we get him a little pair of tzitzis. So he practices. That's the rabbinic mitzvah of chinuch. That we get the child involved. We get him to practice the mitzvot. You get a child to practice saying Kriya Shema every morning and every night. You say it with him. You practice it with him. You daven with a child. He has to practice. We don't just say what the Torah says, when you become an adult, that's when you're going to have to do all this. You let him practice from when he's a child, whenever he's ready for a mitzvah.
It would be also hard for an adult. He never practices when he becomes an
adult. Right. It's logical he should practice, but it's also expensive. Now you're going to buy him a pair of tzitzis, and then you're going to have to buy him another one. And now you're going to buy him a loaf and esrog. It gets expensive. But okay, that's what our sages instituted. So we have to get into that mindset. Parents sometimes say, why should my son have special clothing for Shabbos? I'll get him a white shirt for Shabbos. Why should I spend that money? No, you want him to be accustomed to the idea that on Shabbos you dress a certain way, you behave a certain way. Get him used to it. People sometimes say, what do I need the kid to go to shul for? You're right. If he's not yet at the age where he appreciates going to shul, fine. But once he reaches a certain age, so then you try to entice him to come to shul. First you take him Friday night, you take him to the short davening, you take him when there's a lot of singing, you make sure there's a candy man there. You guys know that I invent candy men wherever I go. I carry candies in my pocket, and if there's no candy man in shul, then when my son's not looking, I'll go to someone and I'll say, do me a favor. bring the kid a candy, and the kids have to have an exciting thing in shul. Slowly. But we do have to get them accustomed to good habits, and part of it is to sit in and hear the rabbi speak. It's a good thing. Why shouldn't the kid follow it? I'm sometimes shocked with what kids quote me from my speech. On Shabbos, I'm a rabbi in a community, so on Shabbos, the kids, I try to speak at a level where the kids can also understand, and I feel very badly that a lot of the kids walk out, but the kids that stay will sometimes come to me after the speech at the end of davening, and they'll start asking me questions, because kids can also understand. There's a lot that they can understand. So we have a mitzvah of chinuch, and part of chinuch is getting the kid to practice, to be a part of Jewish life. So if there are guests coming, you could tell the kid, give the guest first. Get him into the habit that you appreciate having guests. Get him into the habit of doing things for the guest. Shabbos is coming. So we tell the children, clean your room for Shabbos. It's much easier for me to clean their room. After they sweep the floor, I have to sweep it all over again. But they should have the habit of sweeping the floor. So part of our job as parents is to get them into the habit of what it means to live a Jewish lifestyle. And that means giving them jobs, and that means making them a part of what's going on. So here the Torah gave us a biblical mitzvah that we're responsible, even before the kid understands what's going on, we're responsible that they don't become defiled. So that's a fantastic mitzvah. Ordinarily, most mitzvahs don't work that way. Most mitzvahs, we have two rules. One is the kid has to be ready for it. It has to be applicable to him. A kid that's still wetting his clothes doesn't have to get a tzitzis. He has to understand what's going on. And number two is, you don't pain a child. Meaning, yes, we don't eat before Kiddush. But children do eat before Kiddush. You just tell him, remember, when you'll be an adult, you won't eat before Kiddush. But when he's a child, let him eat before Kiddush. Those of you who have come to my house know that I have a two-year-old that sticks her hand into the egg salad if you don't give her some. So we could be standing there about to start Kiddush, and I see her hand going for the egg salad, and I say, 1 second, and I put egg salad on her plate, let her enjoy the egg salad. It's only waiting 2 minutes. Right, but she doesn't have to wait those 2 minutes. And the same thing with Havdalah. Anything that's difficult for a child, that's painful to a child, that's difficult for a child, you don't really have the mitzvah of chinuch there. You could tell him, when he's old enough, not when he's two, you could tell him, you know, when you'll be an adult, then you'll wait till Kiddush, and then you'll eat. But there's no reason to keep him from eating when he's still a child. People sometimes tell their seven-year-old, why don't you try fasting on Yom Kippur? Bad idea. Let the seven-year-old eat, and just tell him, when you'll be an adult, then you'll fast on Yom Kippur. Right now, you're fasting when you sleep. That's good enough.
Well, don't a lot of people give, like, their kids, like, a practice fast, like, they'll just eat less? Or, like, lighter,
no. Let the kid eat when he has to eat. As he approaches bar mitzvah. So sometimes the child himself says, you know, I feel that I could fast till 10 in the morning. Fine, if he really can do it. Depends on the age and the health of the child.
But a child says to you, I really, really want to fast.
On Yom Kippur? No, you don't let him.
You don't let him?
No, because it's not healthy for him. Okay, so now the Kohanim have a mitzvah that they have to become defiled for their close relatives. And this involves the mitzvah of mourning as well. We mourn for the same relatives that one has to become defiled for. There was once a Kohen who said, I'll hire people. I don't want to become defiled. Pesach is just here. I want to go bring my Paschal offering. I don't want to go to the funeral. I know it's my sister. I know I have to help. I'll fund the funeral. I'll take care of everything. I don't want to become defiled. So the other Kohanim shoved him onto the body. They shoved him into the funeral. And they said, yes, you will. That's your mitzvah, whether you like it or not. Your mitzvah is to be there and be a part of it. Right. Now, the Kohen Gadol doesn't become defiled for his father or mother or any relative. Except one thing. The Kohen Gadol is walking down the street and there's a met mitzvah. What's a met mitzvah? Met mitzvah is a dead body that has no relatives and there's no one there to take care of the body. So where do you have a met mitzvah? A met mitzvah, you have to imagine, where do you have a met mitzvah?
In war?
It could be in war, or it could be that there's a bar in town where suddenly someone shows up and his clothing are all destroyed, and he speaks filthy language, and he seems like a real bum. And he says, give me a drink. And they say, who are you? Who says you're going to pay? He says, okay, I'll pay. And he takes out some money, and he puts it on the table, and he pays, and he takes his drink. And then he gets all drunk, and he says, what bracha achrona do I make after that drink? So you see, he's Jewish. Everyone knows he's Jewish. And everyone's wondering, who's this guy walking around town? And then the Kohen Gadol is going out to prepare his mind for Yom Kippur. He's preparing his thoughts. It's a day before Yom Kippur, and he wants to have the purest thoughts. So he walks out into the forest, and he walks deep into the forest where he won't hear anyone, and he wants to focus his thoughts so he's completely for the sake of Hashem. And as he's there deep in the forest, he's walked an hour and a half into the forest. There's no one around. He sees that guy who no one knows, dead on the floor. Jack, are you okay? I don't know your name. Are you okay? He's scared he's dead. If he walks over and deals with him, he won't do the service. All of Israel's waiting for him. He's the holiest man in town, right? Every day now they've been sprinkling on him from the red heifer just in case maybe one time he became defiled. They never gave him a vessel in those 7 days preparation for Yom Kippur. Even the vessels he used were vessels that could never be defiled. Vessels that were so pure, they were made in a way that couldn't even be defiled. Stoneware vessels. But now there's this body on the floor. But this guy, come on, all of town's been talking about what kind of bum he is. Comes the Torah and says, he's a human being. And we have to have value for every human being. And so the Torah says, the Kohen Gadol doesn't become defiled for his father and mother, someone else will take care of them. Doesn't become defiled for his sister or brother, someone else will take care of them. Doesn't become defiled for his son or daughter, but he does become defiled for that bum who's lying there because there's a human body and there's no one around to take care of it. And if he runs back to town, who knows what jackals, who knows what's going to happen with that body? Came the Torah and taught us the value of human life. Part of the value of human life is how we treat the deceased. If we look at a human being as a sophisticated animal, then you could take that body and burn it. You could take that body and feed it to jackals. You could say, what difference does it make? He's dead. But we say no. God gave us a soul in a body. And even though the soul has left, we still treat the body with respect. And that perspective on human dignity, that perspective is what the Torah taught us. That even the holiest man, even though it means he won't be the one who's doing the service of the Yom Kippur, he has to become defiled and bury that body. And from here we learn the important concept of kavod habrios, human dignity. And we have a rule that although the Torah supersedes human dignity, meaning a person can't say, I don't feel so comfortable doing this mitzvah. We say, do the mitzvah, what do you mean? Yeah, but if I put on tefillin, maybe my friends will laugh at me. So we say, put on tefillin. I don't care if your friends are going to laugh at you. The Torah says, put on tefillin, put on tefillin. But what happens if a person goes to the bathroom and he doesn't have any cut toilet paper and he's going to have to tear toilet paper or he's going to have to do something that's rabbinically prohibited on Shabbos? His alternative is to call out and say, anyone hear me? Could anyone get me some toilet paper? Comes the halacha and says, that's not so dignified, right? A person's pretty embarrassed to do that. So for the sake of human dignity, you're allowed to transgress certain rabbinic mitzvot. That's this idea, that the Torah came and stressed human dignity. So when it's standing against the biblical mitzvah, we say, well, the Torah wins. But when it's standing against the rabbinic mitzvah, so very often we say human dignity wins, and this idea of human dignity is learned from this mitzvah. That we say, even though the Torah came and taught us, even the Kohen Gadol should become defiled in order for us to have this appreciation for human dignity. What would happen?
Afterwards, for like if it's right before Yom Kippur.
There's always a runner-up. We always prepare a second.
But what if it's in like an alleyway in the city and you know someone else?
So if he could call someone else, he'll call someone else to do it. But that's why I gave the example when there's no one's around. Yes?
What if it's like, that would be a close relative of his, but he knows that if he doesn't do it, she's not going to get married, or he's not going to get married.
Buried? Then it's a mes mitzvah. Correct. Yes.
For a Kohen Gadol, you count any family members, right? You cannot go to family.
Correct.
Any family members.
But
only
if that
Kohen,
family.
You go to the seven,
correct.
And the Kohen Gadol can only marry family members.
Correct. Now, we discussed a little bit about education. We should add one more point. There are certain responsibilities that parents have for their kids. And one of those responsibilities is to teach them a trade. Father is responsible to circumcise his son, but if he didn't, then the kid has to circumcise himself. If it's a firstborn child, then the father has a mitzvah to do pidyon haben, to redeem the child, to pay a coin, 5 silver coins, the way the Torah explains, and redeem the child. But if the parent didn't do it, then the person should do it for himself. We have, every few weeks, we have a guy who comes to Machon Meir and discovers his parents didn't do pidyon haben for him. So he goes and does it for himself. So there are certain mitzvot that a parent has for a child, and one of them is to make sure the child has a trade. What?
A trade?
A trade. He can make a living. When my father taught us how to drive, he told us, I just fulfilled my responsibility to teach you a trade. Because worst case scenario, you could be a taxi driver. No. That's also a trade. Yes, my father was very serious. He said, I'm funding your classes, your driving lessons, because I'm fulfilling this mitzvah. At the end of the day, you should always know you could be a taxi driver. You have a trade in your pocket. You could make a living. I hope you'll do something different. But I did my minimum as a parent. Oh, that's an interesting perspective. Okay. There are different... What?
Can a child use that as a reason why their parents should pay for their college?
Yeah. But a parent could say, I paid for your driving lessons. I mean, it's an angle, but I'm just saying there are answers to that angle. But a parent could also say, okay, that's my mitzvah too, because I want you to have that trade. That's okay. That's also a parent's mitzvah. Okay. We discussed that there's a limitation over whom a kohen may marry. So the Torah says a regular kohen, and this is relevant today, may not marry a zona. What's a zona? So that's any woman who had intimate relations with someone that's prohibited to her. Meaning, we have very often now, one of the difficult things is for kohanim or chozer b'tshuva to find the shidduch. Why? Because very often a chozer b'tshuva wants to marry a chozeret b'tshuva. And a chozeret b'tshuva, well, very often she has a history. Our assumption is that if a guy or a girl are dating someone who did tshuva, that they're not a virgin, the guy or the girl. So very often the people she was with, well, one of them might have been not Jewish. So that makes her into a zonah. If he had any other prohibition for her to sleep with, so then she'd be a zonah. And then a kohen would be prohibited from marrying her. So kohanim... have it a little tougher when it comes to finding a shidduch. Another difficulty, and that's why in Russia, kohanim have a very hard time finding a shidduch, is that a kohen is not supposed to marry a girl whose father is not Jewish, even though her mother's Jewish, and technically she's a Jewish girl. But a kohen is not supposed to marry her. So that makes it very difficult, because in Russia, many of the Jews, their mother's Jewish, but not their father. So kohanim or chozer b'tshuva have it a little tougher, or maybe a lot tougher, to find the shidduch. Okay. Now, some Kohanim think that they can say, this is a mistake, but they think that they can say, I'll forgo my kahuna, I love her so much, I'll marry her. No. Every day he's married to her, he's transgressing a biblical prohibition. You can't say, I rather her, I'll disqualify myself. Doesn't work. First of all, he's disqualifying his children, not himself. Secondly, there's a biblical prohibition. Every day he's married to her, he's transgressing. So there's no such concept that a kohen can say it.
What if the kohen wasn't really a kohen?
Oh, so that's an excellent question. What happens if his father did that? His father married a divorcee. So now he's a chalal. He's a disqualified kohen. So then he could marry any girl that he'd want.
Most
then he could.
Guys are probably like that.
What?
Think about all the people that
So that's an excellent question. Oh, who wrote about that? Ooh, I think it's a... one, who wrote about that? The Marshal. I think it's a tshuva of the Marshal, a contemporary of the Ramo, where he was asked your question. Michael just asked a fantastic question, and the Marshal asks, I'm 99% sure it's the Marshal, who addresses the following question. He says, being that the Crusaders are coming through our villages so often, and throughout our history, you had pogroms, and you had the Jewish people have had such a history, and we know that there's hardly a girl that wasn't raped by a non-Jewish man. Listen to what he writes. Scary thought. So why don't we say what Michael just said? That all of our Kohanim have been disqualified by now, and Kohen should be allowed to marry any woman he wants, because Kohanim are disqualified, right? So he says like this. He says, it's true. But what's also true is that most women, we assume that most of the times, or all of the times she became pregnant, it was from her husband. It's true that they had crusaders running through their towns, let's say, once every 3 years. Let's say when things were really bad. Even once a year. But 360 days a year, she's with her husband. So we don't assume that the child that came out came from Mr. Crusader. It's true, but that blew my mind when I saw that tshuva, that he writes, it's true that there's hardly a girl in town that hasn't been raped by a non-Jew. That's what he writes. So he addresses this question that you just raised. And it's, yes, Baruch. I'll tell you, when you raise your hand, I see you.
Let's say that one out of every five Kohanim were disqualified, right? Okay.
I don't know why we would say that, but
I'm given a rough ballpark number, right? Of all the history, let's say a very generous number, right? That's toward the Kohanim. One of five is qualified. Okay. Some of these Kohanim may have more kids than regular Kohanim, because therefore the numbers of Kohanim that are disqualified may have increased in number. The only part I'm placing found true Kohanim is the pride among Sephardic communities.
Okay. Yes, Malachi.
What about the Enlightenment period, when the Jews were going to also other cities of non-Jews? What about if we have Kohanim which are kids of a relationship that was with a Jew and a non-Jewish woman that might be converted? How do we know the number from there? I mean, what I want to say is that through the last years of assimilation, that we have a lot of assimilation, and return to Judaism, assimilation back to Judaism, we might have many Kohanim, especially in countries which the Jews were most assimilated in a great number, that they might also be disqualified, indeed.
Right.
So how can we know about these countries, like Germany or United States today, or England or France?
So we have to discern, you're right. And this is a responsa, the responses that discuss this, one of the responses that discussed this was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. When he wrote his work about return to Zion, so what he wanted was to rebuild the temple. And if you're going to rebuild the temple, so then you need Kohanim. So he went to Baron Rothschild and said to him, I need you to fund this whole plan of bringing people back to Zion, and then you could be the Mashiach. So somehow he got Baron Rothschild on the bandwagon and got good money. And he started bringing people back. And he wrote this whole long essay about...
Well,
he said to him, you know, if you'll be the one that initiates this, then there's a strong possibility that part of the Mashiach's job is to rebuild the temple and to get people back to Israel. So this is the step in that direction of you becoming the Mashiach. Now, how exactly he worded it to Baron Rothschild, I wasn't in the room at the time. So, but all I can say is that he got the money.
I'd be sold.
You'd be sold. Okay. So, at any rate, he wrote this essay. And in the essay, one of the questions he addresses is, to what regard do we rely on the Kohanim today being Kohanim? Meaning, the questions you all are raising are very good questions. And we have to discern a little bit. Meaning, the fact that I'm giving the Kohen the first Aliyah to the Sefer Torah, nope. That's not such a biblical thing. Maybe I'm fulfilling a biblical mitzvah, v'kidashto. But let's say I gave the wrong person Kohen. Okay, you understand, I didn't do anything too terrible, right? The fact that I call him Mr. Kohen and that I let him bench first, nope. If I made a mistake, it's not too terrible. But if I'm going to let him be a Kohen in the temple and bring sacrifices, now I'm dealing biblical. He deserves the death penalty if I'm wrong, right? So here, we need to know how strongly do we hold that our Kohanim are kosher, legitimate Kohanim. So he works it out in that work where he comes out and says that we do assume that our Kohanim are kosher, legitimate Kohanim, even for biblical mitzvot. And the strength of his work is not only because he wrote it, but because he sent it to Rabbi Akiva Eiger and asked him to give him a letter of approbation. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger did. Rabbi Akiva Eiger gave him a letter of approbation. So that's where it is assumed that because he had Rabbi Akiva Eiger backing him, that we do assume our Kohanim, even for biblical matters. And this really, this is very important because sometimes we have stories where we very much want to be lenient. For example, there's a famous story with Rav Soloveitchik, where there was a guy who wasn't into Judaism, and he was a Jew, and he met a girl who wasn't even Jewish, and they were together, and then she said to him, you know, why don't you find out about your heritage? So she got him to start studying Judaism, and she got very into it, and she became a very pious woman and converted to Judaism, and dragged him along, and got him into yeshiva, and got him learning, and got him into it, and then he was chozer b'tshuva, and she became a gioris. And now they want to get married legally and correctly. So they set a wedding date and they give out invitations. And then he was told that there's a custom that before the wedding, you go to your father's grave and you bring an invitation to the grave. So he started doing research where exactly his father was buried, and he made the trek out there. It was in a different state. And he traveled out with an invitation, and he comes back and he tells his friend, there was a funny thing on the graveyard. There were these two hands like this. You know, the way the Kohanim set their hands when they make the blessing, Birchas Kohanim? So they start researching it, and they brought the question to Rav Soloveitchik. And Rav Soloveitchik looked into it, and at the end of the day, he said, I'm very sorry, you two cannot get married. And these two who had been together, she brought him back to Judaism, these two tzaddikim, who wanted to continue their life together, to get married, separated. Because a Kohen is not allowed to marry a woman who has had improper relationships. And this woman who was a Gioris, true story.
The thing is with the Baal Teshuva, like, is it, I mean, cannot be, if assuming that, let's say, his parents were not religious, never, I mean, you can't assume that he, or, you know, or his wife, or had Kohen's wife had improper relations.
So that's where Rav Soloveitchik looked into it. You're right, it's a good question. Whatever he verified, he found that he couldn't be lenient. So that's why I'm saying it has a lot of pertinence, this question of how valid are our Kohanim. Not so much for us, as much as for them, for the Kohen himself. You're right. Okay, yes.
So the first is that the son of a, or the child of a Kohen, sorry, if a Kohen is in proper relation, then their child can marry whomever, right?
I didn't understand the question.
The child of... Sorry, I'm trying to get this right. The Kohen cannot have, you know, is prohibited from certain... What's the term to refer to?
You mean the Moni?
The Moni?
He's not allowed to marry certain women. And if he does, then he desecrates his son, and his son is called a halal. A halal is not limited. A halal may marry these women.
But the halal cannot be sacrificed.
But he cannot do sacrifices. So, he doesn't get the aliyah of Kohen. He is desecrated from being a Kohen.
So the halal is not limited to whom they can marry, but say that they marry someone that would be kosher, were they not a halal anyway. And then the
I didn't hear you.
But if the halal marries someone that would be kosher for a kohen, even if were he not a halal, like just a...
He can marry whoever he wants.
Then
his children are still halalim. That's it, yeah.
Where did we learn that from?
From the psukim. We have to go through the psukim and see how that's derived. What could happen is the halal could have a daughter. If the halal marries an Israelite and has a daughter, so then that daughter could marry a Kohen and then fix up everything. Oh. There is an opinion in the Gemara that discusses Bnos Yisrael, Mikveh Taharahen, whatever. This is all Gemaros in Kiddushin about how the halal can get out of it, and there are machlokas Tanan. Okay. We've spent a lot of time on this, and I don't mind. I'm just saying there's a whole parasha still to cover and only 7 minutes to do it, but okay. I'm with you.
I just want a quick question. If Cohen is married to someone that is forbidden to marry the Grusha, the Machutz, or whatever, could he still be called up for an aliyah?
Yes. Technically, yes. Technically, yes. And really, no.
We're going to adopt it.
Okay, so I have to explain. In order for a Kohen to be given the honors of a Kohen, he can't do things that desecrate the holiness of a Kohen. And then the question is, what are acts that desecrate the holiness of a Kohen? And generally, like marrying a Grusha or Chalutza would be acts that desecrate the holiness of a Kohen. So then the answer is no. He could not. He could not be called up as Kohen. What?
That would be like a rabbi at a shul, and you know that one congregates a Kohen.
It's very sticky. We've had huge issues on this matter, right? Give him maftir. Give him agba. Give him psicha. And even that's not so clear, because we don't honor sinners. So if the guy doesn't know anything, it's one thing. But if the guy knows, and he doesn't care that he's sinning, so then it's not so clear that you can just give him an honor. But okay, that's a complicated question that, you know, each case you have to see what's really going on there. Yes, Daniel?
You might have answered a good question that I've always had, like, you know, when it comes to rape throughout the ages, quite unfortunately, and the next more pertinent question is with Moseiros. Like, let's say the woman gets born and you know that she was raped, but, you know, I mean, this has got to have been a case that's happened. I mean,
right, but the child isn't a mamzer.
Well, he would have been born from a...
Right, but he's still not a mamzer.
Because it was by force?
Correct.
Okay, because it's only mamzer is only relevant if the woman voluntarily was another man. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I've heard that... a woman that is converted cannot marry a Kohen because she's like a woman that had inappropriate relations.
Correct.
She's like a woman not because she could be indeed a woman with inappropriate relationships. Meaning that during the time of the Maccabees, for example, we had forced converts on a north. So what happens if a family was forcibly converted to Judaism and they had a small daughter, 2 years old, that was also converted to Judaism. And she grows. She never had improbable relationship. Can she marry a Kohen or not?
Yeah.
Yes?
No? The answer is yes, but you don't understand my yes because there's too much to discuss. So you can't extrapolate from it, meaning In the scenario you gave, yes. But you have to understand the details of it, which would involve a much longer class, which we don't have time to.
Okay.
There are too many details to cover here.
It has to do with, first of all, with her age?
Correct.
Because she was not free yet?
Correct. But you have to understand
there's
that.
More I know.
Okay, let's try. We have 4 minutes left. Let's try to cover a few more things. The Torah tells us that if a person ate truma, if he ate from the, you take off from the grains to give to the kohen, so that's truma and that's holy, and only a kohen may eat it when he's holy, meaning not when he's defiled. And if someone else eats it, so then they have to add a fifth. So the question is, what does it mean to add a fifth? So let's say you ate 20 pounds of truma figs. Wow. So you would say, pay back 24 pounds, right? What's a fifth of 24? But there are two ways of understanding what the Torah means when it says a fifth. Meaning one way of understanding is, milagav, the way we do math, one fifth of 20 is 4. There's another way of understanding it, and that is add a fifth, meaning a fifth portion is what you're going to add, but you divide the 20 into 4 portions, meaning that when the Torah says one-fifth, it means your portion is the fifth portion, but what you're really dividing the 20 into is 4 portions, and that's how we rule halachically, that when the Torah uses fractions, the Torah doesn't mean the fraction the way we say. The Torah means milibar. The Torah means divide the number from within and add a fifth section that's equal to the first 4. So then a fifth of 20 would be 5. Divide 20 into 4 parts and add a fifth part that's equal to the first 4. So that's how we rule, that the Torah's way of saying fractions is not the way we use fractions. It's a machlokas in the Gemara. But we rule that that's how the Torah means when it says fractions. What?
What you ate, a fifth, you add. That's what you said?
Correct. Yes?
Use your example. If I had eaten 20 pounds of these figs, I would add...
It would be pretty big. Let's see what you're right.
I would add 4 pounds then?
5 pounds.
You add 5. You're dividing the 4, you're adding the 5th one.
Equal to 20 divided by 4, so 20 divided by 4 is 5, so you would add it. You need a number that when you take a fifth away from it, you get the original. So you need a plus, a fifth plus. No, you have a marker here. Minus the fifth, which is 24. Not 20 plus a fifth, which is 24. Okay, we're getting pictures now on the board.
Professor and Rabbi Frank.
We have 20 here. Okay? When we say a fifth portion, do we mean divide this into 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It makes 4.
And each, so you take out 4 out of the 20 and you add 4, right? Is that a fifth? Or do I mean divide this into 4 sections, 1, 2, 3, 4, and add a fifth section that's equal to the first 4? When I say a fifth, do I mean divide this by 5, or do I mean add a fifth that's equal to this being divided into 4?
Interesting.
That's the question.
So we rule logically that when it says a fifth, we mean a fifth.
That's equal to having divided this into 4 equal sections, and now I have a fifth section equal to the first 4. So then simply, what that means is that when the Torah says a fifth, the Torah means in our mathematics a fourth. But now you understand why. Why it works that way. Clear? Yes, Malachi.
You said this thing is in the Gemara, right?
Correct.
Do you remember which two are giving this opinion?
No. No, but we can look it up.
Because it's like very good maths.
What?
It's very good maths. I mean, it's a very
smart.
Okay. Okay.
We go with the second set, right? The fifth, the five.
We go with the second opinion. That's how we rule halachically. And we're out of time. Okay, so.